This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is comic and actor Patton Oswalt. In 2002, Entertainment Weekly named him their It Comedian of the Year, describing him as one of stand-up's most scathingly literate minds. His newest stand-up special, No Reason to Complain, premieres on Comedy Central this weekend. Oswalt's previous specials have been shown on Comedy Central and HBO, and he appears frequently on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. On the CBS sitcom The King of Queens, he plays Spence. And in the movies, he's been seen recently as the monkey photographer in Zoolander, the disco DJ in Starsky and Hutch, and as Delmer Darian in Magnolia. He's written for Mad TV and been hired to punch up screenplays. Oswalt's first comedy CD was called Feelin' Kinda Patton. Terry spoke with Patton Oswalt in July when that comedy CD was released. Let's start with a track from it called How We Won the War.
I don't have any material about the war or anything like that, man. I just don't have... Because guess what, hippies? We f***ing won! Yeah! We went in there and we met our stated objective to, hang on. We went in, here's... Wait. To go to liberate the... Hang on. No. Here's where we went. Wait a minute. We went to get the, to strike a... thing, we f***ing won, okay? It's like our country is being run by a bunch of, like, bad alcoholic dads right now, or, you know, it's like, you said you'd get me a bicycle for my birthday. It's a drawing of a bike. Go out and play. Leave Daddy alone. Daddy's drinking. Go outside. Drawing of a bike. Close enough.
Patton Oswalt, welcome to Fresh Air. What kind of reactions do you get to your political material?
It's a real mixed reaction these days, and that was the main reason I put the CD out. You know, I'm on a sitcom, so a lot of people, I either get, you know, people that have seen my stand-up for the 16 years that I've done it and go, oh yeah, he does political stuff, whatever. Or I get people who have seen me on the sitcom or on TV and are expecting... a very family-friendly kind of evening, and I either get, like, disappointment, which is always depressing, or kind of condescending outrage of, like, hey, you dumb sitcom actor, you don't have an opinion on, like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like I'm, it's like, it's almost like I'm being viewed as a dilettante, I guess, whereas I've been doing this stuff for a long time, so... There was, you know, the reactions are always very mixed. I've gotten some very violent reactions, especially in, of all places, Pittsburgh, where I was booed off stage.
Really? What got you booed off stage?
The material about Bush. They mm-hmm. just got really, really quiet during that whole section, and then I went back into my other stuff, and then there was a moment of silence, and a guy in the front row said... why don't you take your faggot ass back to Hollywood? Like, really sharp, like the whole room heard it. And then I kind of went, ha, are you still angry about the Bush stuff? And the whole crowd just all started, like, screaming and pounding their tables. They were all, it was 300 people at the Funny Bone in Pittsburgh pounding their tables and chanting Bush rocks. And I had to be led off stage by the club owner while people were throwing drinks on me and throwing fried shrimp at me. And
wow.
I got locked up in the manager's office because they'd locked me up in there because people, you know, wouldn't leave and fights were breaking out and people were down at the bar going, send him down here. You know, like, it was insane.
Now, so where do you put your political material in the context of a set? Do you lead with it and then risk getting booed off stage before you've even gotten started? Do you put it in the middle where you can kind of sneak it in? Or
yeah, I never lead with it. I remember a long time ago when I was starting out and I was, it's just such a, you know, I want to be edgy. And I would just come right out of the gate trying to freak people out. And I was working with, of all people, Bill Hicks in North Carolina. And he said, you need to walk them towards the edge. Do you understand? You got to walk them towards the edge, man. So I've always remembered that. So, you know, I just do, I do jokes that have nothing to do with politics. And then I do jokes that are very personal and then jokes that have to do with politics, and I think I've learned now how to mix it in a little better and, you know, get them to at least trust you and go, oh, okay, he's funny, you know, he knows what he's doing as a comedian, and then start edging in. And I think now I make fun of both sides equally, but the minute you make fun of one person's side, they just you know, arms folded across the chest and super angry.
When you were a kid and you were being funny, was that considered in your family a discipline problem?
It depends. I mean, I could be funny and they would appreciate it, and then other times I was just a loudmouth and I would just embarrass them. Or I'd get into arguments with my grandfathers, who were both very conservative, and just ruined family dinners, and it was always a drag. I look back on some of my behavior and go, oh man, I'm amazed my dad just didn't hit me with a pipe, because if I could go back now and see myself and my dad, I would tell my dad to hit me with a pipe. I wasn't like a bad kid, but I was the classic overeducated rebellious teenager, but rebellious within just disagreeing with stuff for no reason. So I was the kind of kid when my parents would go, well, it's raining outside, son. I'm like, what do you mean? Just because there's water coming out of the sky doesn't mean it's raining, man. You know, I was like the safest, plushiest suburban punk. You know what I mean? Like, no, I had never felt any real doubt or pain or anything like that, but I wanted, and it was so sad too, because I realize now I was like that. I missed the whole all the great movements in music. I missed, you know, like all during the late 70s. I was just listening to, you know, Kansas and Styx, and then in the mid 80s, I saw the movie Repo Man and thought I had discovered punk, and I was the classic like unhip, letting you in on it kid. So like, it's 1985, and I'm in Sterling, Virginia, going, hey man, have you heard of a group called Fear? Because you got, and we're like, yeah, yes, 5 years ago, Patton. What are you babbling about? Like, you know, I missed the whole, I was living outside of DC and I never saw Fugazi, for crying out loud. I went and saw Genesis on the Invisible Touch tour, so I had no basis for my rebellion.
Your father was a Marine, so was he even more into discipline when you were into being rebellious?
My dad actually, I feel like, was rebelling against his upbringing, in that I think he had a pretty strict upbringing, and he was going, well, I don't want to put that on my kids. I do remember one night he told me, I don't want to ever see you and your brother go to war. So I think he was the kind of warrior who had seen, you know, 3 years of combat and realized how, I think, pointless and brutal and impersonal it was, and, you know, was very much a man of peace because of it. Even though, you know, he was still very much, he and my mom are very conservative people, and yet they're embarrassed, but they're not like just, you know, cold ideologues. So as far as discipline, you know, my dad had a much more kind of passive way of going about it. He was smart enough to let me alone to just read and daydream and, you know, come up with my own thing.
Were you named for General Patton?
I was named for General Patton. And you know what, parents, don't put that on your kids. Don't name your kids after world-changing conquerors, because there's no way they're going to live up to it. You know what I mean? This is my son, Alexander MacArthur Tecumseh, you know, Rommel. That's him. And he's ready to take your order at the Starbucks. Like, that's, don't do that to him. It's horrible.
What was your early comedy like when you first got up on stage?
Just really super forgettable, because I came along, I started comedy in 88, and it was a really good and bad time to start. It was good because the boom was dying, but it was bad, and I'm seeing this happen again with Last Comic Standing, where there were these certain things that everyone knew you had to do as a comedian, and there was this mentality of, you've got one shot. You've got one shot. You spend your time now getting ready for that one shot, and if you blow it, you're done. And it was also all about, you get into comedy so that you can get out of comedy, so that you can get a sitcom or get into movies and not have to do this anymore. Whereas I was very confused, because I thought doing comedy was great. Like, I thought that was the reward. I mean, when I became an MC and was making $25 a set, you know, I wasn't rich, but if I did 4 weekends a month, I could pay my rent and buy enough ramen noodles to survive, and I thought that was amazing. Like, I couldn't believe that I only had to work 3 nights a week, and everyone else was... Back then, you had to get your clean 5 minutes and get on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and hope that he called you over to the couch, and that was it. And everyone structured their stuff to be a clean 5 minutes, and I was constantly being pushed and pulled between, you know, trying to be a normal-looking comedian in a suit. I remember I went down to the Potomac Mills Mall and bought these awful, awful double-breasted cheap suits, like four of them, like an orange one and a yellow one and a blue one and a black one with a bunch of colorful shirts and skinny ties. Like, that's what I was going to do. It was awful. And but then I was also, luckily, I had friends like Blaine Kapach and Mark Voice, who were comedians back then, who just were not paying attention to any of that and were kind of the freaks, but I got along with them better because they would reference books that I read and music that I was listening to at the time, but that was kind of how the alternative comedy movement was starting in its own way, so that when we all moved to San Francisco and then later L.A., it was just the people that... Because then once Johnny Carson left The Tonight Show, these guys' plans were in ruins.
Now, you've said you can't argue comedy with anyone. Comedy and eroticism are beyond argument and qualification. If something makes people laugh or arouses them, then the argument is over. Do you ever feel like arguing with an audience and explaining, no, it's funny, let me explain why. Laugh, it's funny.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, it is hard to... It's hard on both sides. Yeah, you want to argue your point. Like the people that were booing me off stage in San Francisco, I literally said, do you really think that after the half-hour set you've just seen where I compared Bush to Lex Luthor and said that he's literally the Antichrist, I literally said that, do you now think that I'm actually pro-Bush? Like, you must know that I'm being ironic right now. I felt like a college professor, like, you know, begging a class not to walk out on me, and they still booed me off stage. So, and also, at the same time, you get frustrated because you see people laughing at something that's so easy and so pandering and hackneyed, but you don't want to be the one going, don't you people see how empty and unnutritious this is? Like, because then you feel like a snob. Like, it's frustrating both ways.
I think it would be great if at the end of your act you left and then you came back on a stage and instead of doing an encore, you critiqued the audience.
That would be fun. Let's review. Now, you laughed hard at this bit and yet were silent for the one after, but that doesn't make sense because it would follow that if you saw the irony in this, you would naturally, like, literally come on with a blackboard. Those who want to stay and take notes, yes, fine.
I want to play another track from your new CD, and this is something totally apolitical. It's called A Christmas Memory.
When I was growing up, my favorite Christmas memory was the Alvin and the Chipmunks album, because we had it on LP, and you know what I'm talking about, Christmas time is here. Remember that song? The little chipmunks are singing, and then there's that guy, Dave, going, all right now, chipmunks, let's all... My brother and I had that on an LP, so what we would do is we would play that as slow, on the slowest speed possible on the record player. So then it sounded like four normal monotone guys just singing this boring Christmas song, and then this demon from like the ninth level of traitors and murderers just screaming at them. And then it was so different. It was like, Christmas, Christmas, time is here. Time for toys and time for cheer.
Simon.
Okay. Okay.
That's from Patton Oswalt's new CD. And, you know, I grew up listening to Alvin and the Chipmunks, and my brother and I used to slow it down. And I think this is just, like, really funny. Can you talk a little bit about... how you decided to make this just like childhood memory into something to do on stage?
Yeah, that's a bit I really like because I feel like I'm kind of unveiling an actuality because the way people react to that, it's something that I think a lot of people did do and didn't realize how funny it was.
Exactly. Like
nothing's funnier than when you're just doing something that you're not intending it to be funny or weird or memorable. It's just something you compulsively want to do out of fun. And so I just it wasn't like I decided to make it a bit. I think that was another one, because I don't sit and write. I go up with some general ideas, but all of my bits usually get written when I'm on stage. And I think I was doing a show near Christmas, and I was doing a couple other bits about Christmas, and then that memory on stage just popped into my head. Because I think that's when I really started getting good, or at least happier with what I was doing, was when I was comfortable enough on stage to just start talking about something and trust that it would go somewhere. You know, and sometimes it doesn't, but when it does, like the Chipmunks bit, it's like, oh, I get a really good, solid, real bit out of it.
When you were growing up, who were the comedians that made you want to be a comic too?
When I was really, really young, Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby's early albums were, like, Why Is There Air? I think is one of the best comedy albums I ever heard. And then there was a Richard Pryor album called Are You Serious, which was... It's the album that covers his transition from being this kind of Las Vegas Bill Cosby clean-cut clone to then being the really, you know, raucous kind of comedian that he became. But it's called Are You Serious? And he's sort of making the transition. Like, he's got one foot in the, you know, Richard Pryor live in concert thing, and he's got his other foot still in Bill Cosby world. And it's so raw and real, and it was so captivating to listen to a guy that was that just that comfortable in being able to put a clanky transitional thing out as an album and be that real on and in the moment on stage. And then much later, when I was starting, Jay Leno, I thought, was one of the greatest comedians I've ever seen live, and which is why I think a lot of comedians are so frustrated with him, because we don't know what happened to him. He was unbelievable as a live comedian, smart and sharp and really kind of irreverent and just didn't seem to care if the audience liked him or not, but like just a rock star. And then he got The Tonight Show, and all of those qualities, it's like he sat on them. I don't get it. And then when he's a guest on other people's shows, he's the old Jay, like super smart, super quick, super funny. I mean, he just did Inside the Actor's Studio and so subversively mocked every single thing that James Lipton was trying to do with him. I was like, what happened to this guy? That's the, You know, it's just so frustrating.
Well, you know, two of the comics who you mentioned who were really influential on you, Bill Cosby and Richard Pryor, are African-American comics who used, you know, their upbringing as the subject of their comedy. Did you feel that your upbringing would be worthy of that? You know, that your suburban upbringing would have the same kind of edge?
No, absolutely not. That's why I was so desperately in my teens flailing to be dangerous. You know, like, oh man, I remember after I saw Repo Man, again, Repo Man. That's how out of touch I was. It took till Repo Man for me to get... I bought like a cheap pair of handcuffs and I would clip them onto my belt loops. Like, I got handcuffs on my belt, look out! You know, could not have been a less dangerous kid if I tried. Like, I'd roll one sleeve up and like wear my boots but not tie the laces up. Because also I thought the idea of a rebel was like Judd Nelson in a Breakfast Club. That's how out of touch I was. Just absolutely no edge, nothing. So, yeah, these guys, like, the thing that also blew me away about, like, Bill Cosby and Richard Pryor was, it wasn't that they were comedians talking about the black experience. They just were amazing comedians who happened to be black. And they would talk about stuff in a way that would just be universal to... A Martian could come down and watch Richard Pryor's concert movies and go, oh, that's what relations are like between men, women, black, white. You know, like, anyone can understand it. It's so amazing how everyone talks about how Richard Pryor was edgy and vulgar and profane, but I think he was one of the most emotionally accessible comedians I've ever seen.
Comic Patton Oswalt talking with Terry Gross last July. His newest stand-up special, No Reason to Complain, premieres on Comedy Central this weekend.